I think that if you take teaching out of leading, you've ripped the heart out. Right? Maybe the lungs, I don't know. Maybe the brain, one of those essential organs. It's an essential function of leading. And I think that those who don't realize that can become very frustrated and stagnated in their own leadership.
Welcome to WorkWise, the growth mindset for wisdom at work from Creativity Labs. I'm Ken Kennard, coach and chief creative officer at Accent Interactive, and with me is Michael Boyes from Credo Consulting. Today we talk about learning styles and if it's possible to learn to be creative.
Ken, here we are behind the mics again. It feels kind of good to be having this conversation.
I kind of missed you, Mike.
Well, I missed you too.
Oh.
But if you hadn't gone away.
Well, I didn't go away because of you.
But you went away and it seemed like you had a, you know, pretty interesting and fun time.
Well, it was my 20th anniversary. I felt like I had to do something.
Well, yeah. And it probably should be with your wife.
Of course.
Well, I just wanted to make sure.
Well, some people actually asked me if I took my kids on the vacation, the anniversary vacation. Absolutely not.
Which, yeah.
Like, why would I do that?
Yeah, unless it was like your 50th or 60th, maybe.
Well, what's funny is I went to my parents' 50th anniversary party. And of course, there's like 70 people there.
Right.
But for my 20th anniversary, no.
No,
I'm not bringing my kids.
You don't have like three generations behind you.
I dumped my kids off with my parents.
You dumped them. Now, did you dump them off right on the heels of that anniversary party?
A few weeks later.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, they had time to recover. So where did you go?
So I went to Hawaii for the first time.
Wow.
It was fun.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. So she's been there, but it was my first time. Right. So I'm just like fresh eyes.
New stuff.
Brought my camera, took a bunch of photos.
Yeah.
It was beautiful.
Yeah. So I'm curious that, you know, we talk about having these four roles of creative, you know, creativity.
Yeah.
And that sounds like you're falling right into the explorer mode right there.
Oh, full on explorer. Yeah. Yeah. The explorer mode's all about finding new things.
Yeah.
And capturing new ideas. And it definitely was that.
Very interesting, huh?
Hiked some mountains, spent time in a crater, went to a bunch of different beaches, looked for some interesting food trucks.
Oh, and you love food.
So
that's like an awesome thing.
It was fun.
Yeah, yeah. So did you have any interesting experiences while you were there besides the craters and the food trucks and
beaches? I had a bunch of different experiences, bunch of different conversations. One of them was I met a woman who's a psychologist. She came to a dinner party that was thrown by our hosts.
I'll bet she was a great lady.
She was fantastic.
Just by nature of her profession. I mean, that tells me all I need to know right there.
Oh, you psychologists.
So you're at a dinner party talking with this lady.
She's an octogenarian.
Octogenarian.
So she's not young. And she says, and we started talking about, you know, our lives and our careers and stuff like that. And I was telling her about Creativity Labs, which, you know, is a chance for me to help teach people, us both as we're partnering, to teach people about creativity in the workplace. And she asked me this question that I've gotten a lot, actually, when I tell people about Creativity Labs. She says, do you think that creativity can be taught? Like, is that an actual, do some people just have it innately, or is it something that someone could develop that you could actually help them get better at?
Do you know what she's doing?
Is she doing?
She's throwing the oldest psychological debate in history to you.
Is she really?
Nature versus nurture. Yeah, nature versus nurture. So is it all nature? Is it all nurture? Right? So what'd you say?
So basically, because I'm in her little Petri dish at this point. I'm in her lab.
You're in a lab, yeah. The psychologists don't really have Petri dishes. I mean, unless they don't clean their offices very well. But most of them don't have Petri dishes. Those are biologists. So she's asking you this question. So it sounds like she has some doubts.
It sounded to me like legitimate doubts about it. And I wondered if it's in a different era that was well established or something. But as you know, I mean, I feel strongly that creativity is a skill, that it can be learned, that people can get better at it by exercising it. And certainly there are parts, once you start applying creativity to something, then you get into, intelligences and talent and ability, right? That requires those creative ideas to take fruition, right?
Yeah.
If you're tone deaf and you can't tell a C from a B and you can't carry a tune in a paper sack, then there may be some limits on your creativity in terms of music ability.
Right.
But that doesn't mean you couldn't exercise creativity in other ways. And that skill of using that creative muscle in other ways is definitely something that can be taught.
Right. So it seems that at least she had in mind, I think probably a lot of folks have in mind, certain kinds of creativity when they think creativity.
Right.
Yeah. Is that, what do you think about that?
Well, I think most people think art, most people think, you know, the arts, you know, that comes to mind, top of mind.
Right.
But actually, in my experience, other professions actually use creative skills a lot more often.
Right.
Because a lot of times these artistic projects tend to go a long time before they see, like the life cycle is very long.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of times in business or in other places, you're using the creative skills in a life cycle that is much shorter.
Right.
So you end up going through the four creative roles that we talk about, explorer, artist, judge, and warrior,
right,
much more often. And so your muscles actually could get quite a bit stronger.
And and I think that the well, for lack of better terms right now, those traditional or untraditional art forms are very visual too, a lot of times.
Sure.
People can see you doing it. So
performing arts.
Painting, performing arts, you're painting and making a sculpture.
Yeah.
You can see that thing coming together.
Right.
But if you're writing a script for a comedy show.
Yeah.
Or you're writing a poem.
Yeah.
Those are long hours and they don't seem, you know, there's this idea that I think that artists are dipsy doodle daisy free spirits that have not a care in the world and they're not connected with reality. And that's just a really poor stereotype.
Yeah. And I think that's why I like the term creatives, because it kind of carries with it not that disconnected from reality kind of connotation, but it carries with it like someone who's actually getting stuff done and working and stuff that gets delivered in the real world.
Real world stuff.
You think more designer, engineer, architect, you know, as opposed to, you know, poet, painter, sculptor, even though those are very tangible things, certainly.
Yeah. So designer, engineer, architect.
Yeah.
Creative professions.
Right.
Yeah. And that doesn't quite fit that stereotype, but at its most fundamental level, that's what those folks are doing. Like they are the folks that create the stuff that we live by that didn't exist before, right? They're the ultimate scientists.
Right.
These guys are the ultimate in creative folks.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think that those things can be taught. But it got me thinking, one of the things she challenged me on is if it can be taught, then how can it be learned? Mm-hmm. So if you look at learning and you say, okay, what does learning look like? What are there different styles of learning or the different kinds of learning or different modes of learning? And so that's what I've spent some time writing about recently.
Okay. So you investigated like what learning entails essentially and asked some questions about it. What were the questions you were exploring?
Well, one question is, I've heard about learning styles forever. Yeah. Everyone talks about, you know, are you a kinesthetic learner? Are you a visual learner? Are you an auditory learner? I thought that was pretty much where it stopped, but I wanted to investigate that further. What else is there? Are there other modes of learning? And then the other question I wanted to address was, so what?
Right.
Like if there are X number of styles or modes or whatever it is, how should that affect my teaching or my leading? If I know, for example, that Jane here is very visual and Joe is very auditory, am I going to do something different with them about that as I lead or teach or mentor or whatever it is?
Of what practical good is this knowledge if in fact those things do exist?
Exactly.
Right.
So I wondered about that.
So I have some background, you know, over the years of encountered learning styles from the psychology perspective.
Right.
And I'm curious as to if where your learning took you is to where my learning took me. So
all right.
So can you tell me what you found or what you're concluding? I'm just going to say concluding.
Yeah, I'm still in process.
Yeah. So what are you thinking?
Well, the first thing I noticed, there's a lot more kinds of ways of looking at styles than I thought.
Yeah.
Right. And it seems like it's not just like three modes of learning, but you can get into all kinds of other perceptual styles, print, oral, haptic, interactive, even olfactory. which is, you know, something the Onion made a quick joke about how, you know, those people who learn through smell and taste, why are they so disenfranchised in public schools?
We should be teaching math through sense.
Yes.
If you take the orange scent and combine it with the licorice scent.
Right, right. So
you get 23.
So the parents of nasal learners are up in arms, apparently, over there on the Onion. But so number one was just the different styles that are out there and the different ways of learning.
Yeah.
The other thing is that, you know, it overlaps with a lot of other things. You see direct relationships with things like intelligence,
right,
and communication and how people process information. And that whole, you know, cycle of getting something in, doing something with it, trying something, seeing what happens, right, and then you've got this feedback loop that we talk about, right, a lot in creativity, yeah, where you say, okay, so what did we learn there? And then, right, how will that learning affect our next try as we go through it again? So
the
just kind of
feedback loop of doing things.
Yeah. So it uncovered all of that.
Right.
Is that where you went with it, or
well,
what?
So this is where. Where my head is on that is I know that the learning styles has always sounded really good, you know, being kinesthetic or auditory or,
yeah,
you know, or visual, you know, or whatever. My difficulty has always been that that the research that I have seen has always been equivocal about it. Some evidence for, some evidence not for, and then... So what do you do with it? And then my question has always been, well, what do you do? So we know that, well, I know, I believe, based on my background, is that the more senses and modes you present something in, the more you solidify your learning about that.
Yeah.
Because your brain is nothing but a big network of connections.
Yeah.
Both in terms of physically... And in terms of the knowledge we have, it's all associations. And so the more associations you get,
yeah,
more ways, the better the more you learn.
So if you had 20 minutes to learn something, it might be better, instead of spending all 20 minutes on one mode, to spend maybe 10 minutes on a primary mode or dominant mode, and maybe split the other 10 minutes, you know, doing a few other modes. I don't know. Just to introduce some more pathways. Is that to the point?
So you hear it, you see it, you do it.
Yeah.
Right. So someone tells you, you look at a diagram.
Yeah.
And then you do it yourself. Or, you know, you're somebody, you hear it, someone does it with you, you watch them.
Yeah.
And then you do it yourself.
That reminds me that some of the best learning I had in college was in my conducting class, where I watched someone do it. Then I did it.
Yeah.
Then I got videotaped doing it.
Oh.
Then I watched the video of me doing it.
Uh-huh.
And that's where I had the aha. I was like, okay, I know I've experienced this already. I know, because I was the one in the video.
Right.
But something just happened here watching myself do it,
mm-hmm,
that I picked up new methods, new associations. And that's when my conducting really took off.
Right.
And my professor actually addressed that with me. He said, why are you so much better this week than you have been in previous weeks?
Right.
And I thought, well, it's probably because I just started watching video about it.
You saw yourself doing it.
Yeah.
As opposed to you experiencing yourself internally.
Right. Which was counterintuitive.
Yeah.
Counterintuitive to me, because doing it sounds, right, like the pinnacle of learning.
Right.
If you had to rate, you know, like if you hear something, how likely are you to remember it? If you see something, how likely are you to remember it?
Right.
Maybe a little more, maybe a little less, right? Yeah. If you actually do it, how likely are you to remember it? I would say probably way more, right?
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. But then you do it. But see, then the question is how you getting feedback?
Right. And you're not getting feedback as much when you're watching, right, people, or even when you're doing it.
Or you open up a whole new avenue of feedback.
Right. Right.
So while you're doing it, you're getting to experiment with how you move and give direction.
Yeah.
And how you direct the people.
Right.
And you're getting the feedback from them on how they're playing.
Right.
But you don't see
what they see,
your physical cues.
Right.
You're making them, but you can't see them how other people see them.
Right.
When you get a video,
right,
it's like when you talk on the radio and you hear your voice.
Right.
Most of us really hate that.
It doesn't sound right.
That's the problem. We the voices we hear in our heads are not the voices other people hear.
I'm actually more handsome in my head than I am on this recording. I just want to say.
I'm younger in my head.
Are you?
And I'm a whole lot blonder.
Oh.
Well, I have blonde, and I've, you know, Gail cut my hair last night. And it was all like dark brown.
Wow.
I'm not dark brown. I'm light brown to blonde.
Yeah, right. Go figure. How does that video work for you?
This is the experience.
Right.
Yeah. So the multi
right.
venue or modal learning.
Multimodal learning. Love that. Yeah.
Is where you get the most learning.
Yeah. Well, there's something else to throw in there. I don't know if just scattering among the modes is necessarily a better approach, though, right. all the time. What do you think about the fact that some kinds of learning might be better applied or done or experienced in certain modes? For example, I was thinking about my music theory teaching. I had a written theory course that I was teaching and an oral theory course I was teaching. And as I reflect back on that, when I was teaching the written course, there was a lot of written work. There was a lot of visual cues. There was a lot of illustrating on the board. Mm-hmm. When I was teaching the oral class, like how to listen to music, understand intervals, identify them, you know, can you tell if this chord is major or minor, this sort of thing.
Right.
We did auditory exercises over 80% of the time. And it's not that we never used visuals, but I found myself going, you know, putting my teaching method, aligning it with the skill, intuitively. And you know, that was an experience, but it was also intuition on my part.
So what you're saying is, it sounds completely reasonable, right? So the learning pathway you use matches the pathway that the learner is going to, how they're going to demonstrate it and express it.
Yes.
Right. So you can look at a guitar and learn, you know, so those are the strings I twang,
right.
I strum, I pick,
yeah.
right? But then you have to do it.
Yeah.
So using the channel, it actually matches. And so, it makes sense. So, you know, I do similar things. So if I'm teaching folks how to resolve conflict, we talk about it verbally and the ideals.
Yeah.
But people aren't able to do it then. And so then I demonstrate.
Okay. Yeah.
And then I put them in the chair and make them actually have to go through.
Yeah.
You know,
role playing.
Yeah. And then I send them out and do it.
Yeah.
Unless they sit down and try to practice that skill.
Yeah.
They haven't really learned anything.
Right.
They've got an ideal in their head.
Right. Which is necessary, but not sufficient.
It's not sufficient. They haven't really learned the art or skill of resolving conflict.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. So I'm wondering that let's circle back then to creativity and to leadership. I mean, what would be, I'm curious about your perspective about teaching creativity, because this is something we're doing more now as we do creativity labs together, and we're partnering on these labs for businesses and organizations. Right. What would be your thoughts about how to teach creativity? If you were going to teach soccer, you would do it on the field. If you're teaching conflict resolution, you would do role play.
Right.
If you're teaching oral theory, you're going to do a lot of oral exercises. Yeah. Creativity, what comes to mind?
Well, I think, and my view on creativity has been forever changed by what you've taught me. I think there's two senses in which we discuss creativity in this regard. One is kind of the sense of the artist or the craftsmanship that we go about our work, the writing, the thinking, the problem solving, the drawing, or whatever it is. There's this artistry we're taught those disciplines in school and in other ways. And so I think that an approach that takes a skill, you know, teach a skill, go practice it, teach a skill, go practice it, and keep on layering and adding things on top. There's an important component of that. Right, a lot of practice, a lot of experiential. I think, though, that what I see now with some of your help is that there's a whole lot more to being creative than just the artistry.
Okay, so you're talking about more the creative roles that are involved in the process.
Exactly. I think this idea of the explorer, the learner, where they're gathering new ideas is very important, but we don't talk about that, and the artist. But then the idea that we have a judge and a warrior involved. And I think that one of the things that we see with entrepreneurs, for example, is a lot of people go into their work because they're great artists. They're great at their craft.
Yeah.
They're unable to sustain it because they're not able to adequately fulfill the roles of judge and warrior. And I think that teaching those roles and integrating them, I think, becomes an essential piece of what it means to be creative, not just to be the artist.
Right. Yeah. People think of the artist as just the maker, just the person who's doing the craft.
Yeah.
And yet it's only 25% of the roles. Yeah. If you think about the whole life cycle, the four roles, like you mentioned.
Yeah.
And not only that, but then in Creativity Labs, we do a whole segment just on integration. We call synergy at the end, which is all about integrating the roles, right. How to get them working amongst themselves and to apply them to a particular task at hand.
Right.
And that's where the fun really, really begins.
And the interplay. So, you know, am I a judge and a warrior at the same time? Or am I an explorer and a warrior at the same time? Which am I? And there's some intermixing in real life
right.
that can still happen. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1,
right.
2, 3, 4.
Right. Right. Exactly.
The waltz happens that
exactly.
way.
Exactly.
But not other things.
The waltz is 1, 2, 3, but I get your point.
Well, yeah. Well, see, that's where you go. That's why I always get it wrong. Well, the 4 was the evaluation.
Oh, the
evaluation.
I got it.
Right,
got
1, 2, 3, evaluate. 1, 2, 3, evaluate. 1, 2, 3, evaluate.
Oh, I'm with you. Yeah. Got it.
Yeah. So I think that that's the beauty in this approach in Creativity Labs is that we have people who are trained in disciplines.
Yes.
Whether it's architecture or accounting or finance or marketing, you know, customer service.
Right.
There's a discipline there in which you have to be an artist.
Yeah.
How do you be creative in that? When you have a new idea to make something better, well, what do you do? How do you get the new idea? And then what do you do once you have it? Well, you got to be a warrior. You got to be a judge. You got to, you know, you have to do something with it. And I think that's where this scheme, is it a scheme? Scheme sounds bad. What is it? A rubric? It's a, what is it?
We call it the creative process.
The
roles in the creative process, understanding the different roles, understanding what the skills are that are in each of those roles, and then understanding how to use those roles effectively for the sake of the process. So Mike, what do you think? I mean, if we're trying to teach creativity, how do we do that? How should we lead people in this exercise so that they get it?
It's going to be experiential, but it's going to be loaded with any bits of skills being taught and then being used.
Bits
of skills being taught and then being used. And it's even better if you let them do something and let them experience a gap between what they wanted. So give them, draw this, do this on your own, just whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
And then here's your result. Now, let me teach you a skill.
Yeah.
Now try it.
Yeah.
Skill, try it, and then encourage it to go out there. So I'm a big believer in, you know, in building little skills at a time and then layering them and putting them on top in real life practice.
Right.
So.
Yeah. And isn't that the way that children who are very creative learn? Yeah. They go out there and they try something. And they see someone else doing something and they try to do it and they can't do it.
Right.
And then they start playing with, what would I have to do to do it like that?
Right.
And they pick up these little skills and they start layering and layering and layering. I see that in my own children, just naturally the way they're approaching it. But it occurs to me that adults aren't that good at doing that. It just seems like they're what has happened? Like we somehow got the idea that this playful, experiential, what seems to me so natural way of learning is somehow like not even been tried in the last, I don't know how many years,
you know,
right?
Maybe, and I just thought of this, maybe it has something to do with testing and grades, right? So now I've learned that I put it behind me and I learned the next thing.
Yeah.
And I'm done that.
Yeah. You're just trying to get a good score.
Right. As opposed to when you're trying to make something, you are making something of your own design.
Yeah.
And you're constantly comparing it to that. So maybe we've gotten too far away from actually using the stuff that we were learning for practical purposes.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I like so much about teaching people in business, because they're so practically minded. You know, if it doesn't work, let's get rid of it, because we're only here to do stuff that works.
Right. Yeah. And what's so funny is adult learning theory always says, well, adult learners are different than children because they use applied knowledge and they're only interested in that. And I'm thinking that's the same for kids.
Yeah.
Like they're going to learn it if they can apply it and use it. It's the same.
Yeah.
All the things we talk about in adult learning theory.
Yeah.
Apply equally to kids.
Right. And the kids are the ones saying, when am I going to use this in the real world? Like, show me that this is really relevant. Because I'm not.
Yeah. When am I going to use algebra 2?
Yeah. Right.
In the real world.
Yeah.
Right. That's what Gabby asked me last year. When am I going to use this? You know, I'm going into politics, and I don't ever see politicians use algebra. I don't know.
Right. I think that's actually a valid concern. I don't know that it necessarily means you shouldn't learn anything you don't think you should know.
Right.
But I think it's a valid, you know, overarching concern that why should we teach things that you're not going to need? Mm-hmm. Let's teach things you need. But let's also teach them in a way that allows you to use it.
Right.
And that's what I like about the Creativity Labs approach, that experiential micro lesson learning.
Yeah.
That we do.
Well, tell us more about that. What do you mean by that? What's happening in the Creativity Labs?
Well, for example,
that you think is really...
What we try to do, number one, is make it relevant to the business that we're helping, right? So when a team comes in, we know what kinds of things they need to do or are trying to do, and so we try to apply the lessons to that.
Right.
An example would be when we worked with a architect in the city, mm-hmm. they needed to survey a neighborhood for some work that they were doing. So we did our visual exercises in that neighborhood.
Right.
So they got a chance to photograph that neighborhood, get to know it better.
Right.
And as a result of that, it seemed a lot more relevant than just doing something in the abstract.
Right.
But secondly, I would say that the micro skills, like you talked about, isolating particular skills mm-hmm. has the advantage of being universally applicable to problems we didn't even know we were going to later need to solve.
Right.
Because those little skills are kind of like the Lego building blocks that can be applied in a lot of different ways.
Right.
So this could be part of a wall, or it could be part of a bridge, or it could be part of a sidewalk. Mm-hmm. And the same is true with those skills, like being a better observer, or knowing how to capture ideas, or giving and receiving feedback. Mm-hmm. These are little skills that are going to end up being applicable, and whoever knows what is the actual project. Is that responsive?
Well, yeah. So there's lots of angles to look at that from. One is from like the neuroscience perspective, but the other one is just from, you know, when we look at high achievers, in particular, if you look at executives in businesses or anywhere really, one of the things you learn about them is that they're learners and they have hobbies and they're learning broadly. And then they're using that knowledge to solve problems. And that relates right back to creativity, because we know two things, but creativity is based on knowledge.
Sure.
It's based a lot on knowledge. And the more broader knowledge you have and experience you have, the more creative you can be.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so it's bringing, you know, building those building blocks, if you will, really... they can be building blocks or they can be hooks to hang things or tying associations mm-hmm. to, which is really how we think. We think in terms of networks of associations.
Yeah.
And when you understand that, you understand a lot about how learning and different experiences, different modes connect you so you can be more creative.
Yeah. You're bringing to mind one of the key skills, the micro skills of the explorer,
right.
which is to, we do an exercise where we take yourself out on a creative date, kind of an artist date kind of a thing, an idea, where you're trying to get yourself out of the normal things that you see and hear and feel and experience new things.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds at the first like it's completely unrelated to the discipline at hand or the projects you're working on. Mm-hmm. And yet once you get out and you start to experience those things, you start to get new hooks.
Yeah.
And you realize, wait a minute, that actually relates to some of the things I'm working on. And you start to get a new angle that you didn't have before on some of the work that you're doing.
And there's a trap there. I think when I see people who, especially in large corporations, they are trained and they work in a discipline and their mind is focused on that function or discipline, accounting or a particular piece of marketing.
Sure.
You know, and they think and they act in that realm. And then they're so busy that the only thing they think about and act upon is in that realm.
Yeah.
And so the experience they have to draw from solving problems becomes very, very myopic.
Yeah.
It's a very limited tool set. And so they really build walls around their capacity to solve problems and to have new solutions and see things in different ways. It's a real problem in business.
Yeah.
One of the things that's common in business and really works for leadership development is to move high potentials, and I'm giving quote marks
here,
potentials, air quotes, thank you, around the organization to different jobs and different functions so that they get a variety of experiences. And they send them out to do different things outside the organization so they can apply. So they're learning, essentially. The answer is that lady's question. Can you learn creativity? Well, that's exactly how we groom executives.
Yeah.
We force them into a variety of experiences so that they can pull knowledge and experiences from different things to solve new problems. So the answer has been solved by smart corporations.
If you're looking for innovation, that's what you would do.
Right.
The argument for keeping the person in the trench is that in the near term, at least, it seems like productivity. I mean, mm-hmm. why not specialize and just get good at the one thing and stay in your trough and just, you know, hoe that row, you know, as much as you can,
right.
because it seems like at the end of the day, you're going to get a lot more productivity, but maybe out of the end of the year.
In a stagnant, that's a nice worldview if you're building widgets in, you know, 1879
right.
or 1925 even, right?
Yeah.
But we're a knowledge economy.
Yeah.
In fact, I would argue, as we've said before, we're moving beyond knowledge and information into creativity.
Yeah.
If you need to solve new problems and innovate and change rapidly, then you need broader experiences and you need people to use their own minds.
Yeah.
And that means broader experiences, new thinking, and the innovation becomes everybody's idea. So making people widgets is great if it's a stagnant world. If it's a dynamic world, not so great.
So maybe Creativity Labs is really for innovation in those organizations. It's the skills needed to get people into making the right kind of connections and the right kind of breakthroughs.
Yeah, we're talking about Creative Labs here. So I think one of the great things about it for businesses is that the skills you need for the future, you need to collaborate, to problem solve, and to act in teams. Those are all things skills that people need to learn. And it's the skills people are looking for in business. I need people who collaborate. I need people who are problem solvers. I need people who can communicate well and coordinate well. That's the creative work of working in a team.
Yeah, but that's not how those same people were brought up. I mean, maybe the millennials would be the only generation we could point to that would say at least have been educated under some of those values.
Yeah.
But certainly not really Generation X, not much. Boomers.
No.
Hardly at all, right? I mean, those values are nice on paper, but they weren't formative values.
They weren't formative values.
In the 50s, 60s, 70s, right?
No, they started asking for them probably in the late 90s, not knowing how to get them or use them.
Yeah.
Now they have them. But yeah, I think Xers in a lot of ways are great at that, except that they're great at using information and putting things together. There's you know a good bit of evidence that creating new knowledge or problem solving is not necessarily the strength of your average ordinary young person coming out of school these days. They ask the question, how do you want me to do this? How is this done?
Oh, I see.
Rather than let me invent this, create this. They're very task focused. What do you want done? How do you want it done? So I can get done and get feedback.
So they're working to the test like they used to be taught to the test, it sounds like.
In some ways, yeah. And in some ways, you know, we see tons of innovation too from people.
Yeah.
Very often outside the realms of corporate America where creativity always comes from.
Yeah.
It's not happening. And a lot of it's not happening inside the walls of the Fortune 500 state companies.
So what kind of mindset does it take for the larger companies to embrace creativity and innovation so that they can have those? Or should they just be resigned to let the younger, you know, cooler, hipper outside organizations come up with the breakthroughs?
So learning is everybody's job. Right, we're talking about learning. You know, innovation and change and creativity—they're all learning processes. And so creativity, innovation, learning is everybody's job. And a lot of organizations have tried to create departments where this is where their learning happens and innovation happens, and then we're going to give it to everybody else to implement.
Yeah.
If you want a creative culture, an innovative culture, then you give that to everybody.
Yeah.
It's not one person's job.
Yeah.
It's everybody's job. That's how you do it.
Yeah.
So yeah. So then how do they learn it? You let them do it.
So it sounds like everyone needs to be involved if it's going to be a cultural shift. Otherwise it's going to be isolated to a group.
So how do they, so that's kind of looping back to learning styles. We started talking about that. Is there a connection to that? If we're getting everybody to innovate and learn, and learning styles are real, if they are. Right?
Yeah. Well,
what's that tell us?
I think that, you know, what I've heard is that what you should do is find out what the learning styles are of the people that you're teaching. Mm-hmm. And then you should teach to the style so that they learn. If that's the way they work best, then that's the way they should learn. I've never embraced that. I don't know number one, I don't know how you could. If you had, you know, 10 people and you had 10 different preferences, what would you do with your curriculum and your teaching style? You know, there's no way that you can really cater to a diverse group of people.
Right.
If you pick any one of them, you're isolating from the others. I don't get that.
Yeah.
I think what makes more sense to me, as I said in the article, is that you should probably go with whatever modality fits with the thing you're trying to teach, and then make that the dominant thing.
Right.
And then complement it with these other pathways, like you said. You know, let's throw in some visual or some kinesthetic if this is an auditory thing, and so on, so that you're definitely filling it out, but you're not trying to cater to the person, you're trying to cater to the material.
Yeah, and I think that makes a lot of sense to me. I think an offshoot of that is that you lead with something. Maybe the modality matches how they're going to use it, but then you give it in other ways. So we're in a business. So if you're on my team and I need you to be innovative, I let you go out and innovate and experience and learn the way you naturally do, what you're going to gravitate towards, which is going to be your learning style. But then we come back and we use it and apply it, and that's going to touch the other. So if I'm auditory, I let you go out and explore and listen to things, and then I let you share it with people, and I let you explain it to people. But we're gonna take that thing and make something out of it and try it. So you're getting feedback other ways too.
Yeah.
So we don't live in a one-dimensional world.
Sure.
We use all of them.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think then if you look at, you know, you're talking about business, you're talking about leaders. Leaders don't necessarily think of themselves as teachers, but if you take teaching out of leading, you've taken out a huge chunk, I think, of what leaders actually do. They're trying to influence people. They're trying to change behavior. They're trying to drive a group of people towards a common vision. That requires educating them on what that vision is and how we're going to get there and what things you're going to need to know. So there's a certain humility and teaching combination there. It seems to me to be a good leader. Don't you think? Or what have you found there?
I think that if you take teaching out of leading, you've ripped the heart out. Right? Maybe the lungs, I don't know. Maybe the brain, one of those essential organs.
Yeah.
It's an essential function of leading. And I think that those who don't realize that can become very frustrated and stagnated in their own leadership.
Yeah.
And so they need to, and I think one of the things you hear when I talk to leaders is about leading, you know, one of the first things they say, it's different for every person.
Mm-hmm.
You have to see what your people need and what they prefer and tailor your style to them. And so I think the question of learning styles and in leadership means the application is, leaders are already seeing I need to work with this person differently than this person.
Yeah.
And I can't approach them as if they're me.
And you can do that on the individual level.
Right.
On the group level, you might need to do it more based on what it is you're trying to accomplish
or
how the group needs to function best.
Exactly. Yeah. So for you, Ken, you've been doing, you know, versions of Creativity Labs for a lot of years.
Yeah.
Give us your summary statement of your approach to engaging learners and teaching them to do creative and novel things.
I think it starts with valuing creativity. You know, sign up for it if you value it, if you need it. Second, take on the learner mindset, which is what we do in that first session, you know, and be open to new things. See this as a chance to pick up new skills and apply them in new ways. Yes, stay committed to results. Results are important, but also for the sake of the learning lab, suspend the attachment to results for the sake of picking up the new skill and playing with it and being okay with failing and trying some new things because you're going to be better for it. And then a very experiential approach. I mean, creativity is experiential. You can't be creative in a vacuum or in isolation. It always expresses itself when attached to some kind of discipline, writing, making, you know, thinking. There's all kinds of stuff that's tangible, music making, whatever it is, that's going to be applied to a discipline. So that interaction between the discipline of creativity, that exercise muscle of coming up with ideas and seeing it through the creative process, when combined with the discipline, is where the magic is.
Right.
And that's where we want to spend our time.
Right. And I look at that and I think about how we in corporations judge people or individuals, essentially. And there's kind of this, at the corporate level, at the organization level, there's a knowledge and understanding that as a whole, the organization is learning and moving forward. It's going to keep on trying and base its new strategies based from what it learned in the last go around and tweak them and always learn. I think at the personal level and or even the team level, I think that a lot of times there's an expectation that you're going to get it right the first time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it's going to be right when you give it to me.
Yeah.
This is going to be the right thing. And you're judged if it's not.
Yeah. Either that, or I've also heard, this sounds like a creative thing. Well, Jim's the creative guy in our team. So
give it to him.
Give it to him.
Yeah.
If you want to succeed, give it to him.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily true, nor is it necessarily the way to get the best result out of the team.
Yeah. So some organizations have allowed, you know, famously have allowed teams and units to learn and be in control of those things. So, you know, there's the famous studies of, you know, Japanese car makers. How have they done it? Well, they've given over responsibility of results and process to independent teams, autonomous teams, where they're responsible for the process, they're responsible, and they get the feedback, and they evaluate themselves, and they continuously improve and they adjust the situations. And that's contrasted with organizations that say, here's how it's done, here's how it works, and we expect perfection out of it.
Yeah.
And so there's no learning there.
Yeah.
And there's no opportunity to say, this isn't working, or let's tweak this because the policy says this.
Right.
Period.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work well, which is why more autocratic directive styles are having a harder time these days than they used to.
Yeah. Well, you can see why.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mike, what questions do you think you could address, or are you curious about investigating on this question?
Well, I think that we talked a lot about learning. That begs the question of, what about intelligence? Because intelligence is defined as the capacity to solve problems or the capacity to learn. And over the last 20, 30 years, we've really learned that there are lots of different intelligences. We used to think of it as a very monolithic thing. But now we have all kinds of intelligence we've kind of defined. And so if we're looking at the business world, I kind of think that it's a core competency that businesses ought to have of identifying different intelligences in people and figuring out how to deploy them and use them and how to nurture those things. I think if the human is the base unit of performance, and it certainly is in an information or creativity economy, then we've got to identify the different kind of intelligences, the kind of creativity that comes out of those things, and how to nurture that. And I think that is something that businesses need to be looking at and getting a whole lot better at. But many just aren't because of a lot of reasons.
Yeah. That sounds fascinating. I would love to be a part of that conversation.
Yeah. Well, let's be part of it.
Okay.
All right.
Hey, thanks for listening to WorkWise, the growth mindset for wisdom at work. And if you want to contact Mike, you can head over to credoconsulting.us. If you want to get a hold of me and our team, go over to accentinteractive.com. And if you're up for a little adventure, head over to creativitylabs.us and check out our Creativity Labs program for teams and organizations to help you be more creative.